Anyway, we've come to the last two verses of the 23rd Psalm tonight, so we've got quite a bit of ground to cover. And I've called verse 5 the badge of victory. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, and my cup overflows. Now, the majority of Bible commentators, I almost say all of the Bible commentators at this point, say that the pastoral imagery of the 23rd Psalm ends at verse 4, and that the last two verses we have the picture of a fugitive in an eastern court. They said that in verse 5 we see the splendor of an eastern banquet where the guest has his head anointed with sweet-scented spikenard, and the hospitality is so lavish that the cups overflow with wine. They add that eastern etiquette was such that to enjoy hospitality was also to enjoy sanctuary. So here is the fugitive sitting down, eating the meal. His enemies are standing there, but they cannot lay hands on him because he is enjoying hospitality at the moment. One writer goes as far as to say that David had exhausted the pastoral metaphor in the first four verses, and so he could give the psalm a happy ending, he had to use a new metaphor. Now, I say as many as 98% of the Bible commentators, even the evangelical commentators that commentate on this psalm, say that the imagery changes here. Now, I'm not happy about that, because it seems to me that you ruin one of the most perfect pieces of literature, as well as one of the most perfect pieces of spiritual writing, if you say that the last two verses has nothing to do with the first four. So I am assuming that there is a unity in the psalm, and the pastoral imagery goes right to the end. I mentioned last week how one of the great commentators on this psalm was John McNeill, and how he began his life as a porter at Inverkip Station in Scotland, and how he was promoted to Greenock Station. Well, that station, both those stations, were serviced by the old London, Midland and Scottish Railway. And even when John McNeill became a great preacher, he always carried his porter's cap badge in his pocket. And when anyone said, "What have you got that for?" he said, "Well, that's my cap badge. You see, it stands, LMS stands for the Lord is my shepherd." And that's why I've called my heading for this verse the badge of victory, because here David is giving us the emblems of safety and the badge of victory. Unlike most biblical commentators, two modern authors, Faduel Mahabhab, who writes in the Song of the Syrian Guest, and Ferrando de Alfonso, who writes in the Basque Shepherd, state emphatically from practical experience that the picture of the shepherd goes right to the end of this psalm. And both of these authors say, and they both used to be shepherds, that what happens in the middle of the day is that the shepherd clears the ground of the enemies to the sheep so that he can have his quiet nap after lunch, and so that he knows that the sheep are going to be safe. Now what he does, he takes his staff and he roots out the poisonous grasses and he leaves them on great rocks so that they dry in the sun and die and can't take root again. And he hunts out the snakes from the ground and so that the sheep can graze while he sleeps without any fear at all. Ferrando de Alfonso says that a cousin of his lost 300 sheep through eating poisonous grass. And the common snake in this region was the horn viper, some 18 inches long, but cobras were not unknown. One morning in 1934, Dr. Leslie Weatherhead reports that he saw two large cobras in northern Palestine within a few miles of each other. Well, anyway, the snakes and the poisonous grass were rooted out. Let's look at one or two words here because they're important. The word prepare is frequently found in scriptures in a logistic military sense. It's used to describe men that were fully equipped for battle. If you've got a notebook and pencil with you, write down 1 Samuel 17 verse 2. The same word prepare is translated in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 2, set in battle array. It's exactly the same word. And these words bring the assurance that we can be equipped by the living God for everything that is necessary to life. If you like, this verse here is the Old Testament equivalent of "My God will supply every need of yours according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus." The fact that David says, "Thou preparest a table," is really David's way of saying that God's provision is not only abundant, but it is immensely practical. And I think what we have to notice in the 20th century is that these words say, "Thou preparest a table in the face of my enemies." Now, I think that that's the significant phrase for us, because I think that in certainly this century and towards the end of the last century, that we had reduced the spiritual drama to two characters, to God and man, and we have forgotten the evil one. We've already looked at the enemies of the flock. If you had asked me last year to list the enemies of a flock of sheep in Palestine, I know the sort of things that I would have put on my list. I would have put the difficult terrain, the difficult ground, such as places like the Wadi El Narar. I think I would have put marauding animals, such as bears and lions and the other animals that David mentions in the Psalms. But in 100 years, I wouldn't have mentioned poisonous grasses or snakes. Now, isn't there a truth there that in the same way we are aware that mankind has enemies, or mankind has an enemy, but we've not really in our own age sorted out our doctrine of that enemy? And I think one of the great dangerous things that we do is to use euphemisms for the devil. Of course, we are amused by John Brown of Haddington's phrase, "His satanic majesty." Sometimes we're amused by the phrase of C.S. Lewis, "Our Father below." And even more amusing, of course, is old Billy Bray's reference to the devil as old smutty face. But this just turns him into the music hall character, makes him a benign, bumbling, old mannish type figure with a cheerful face. And that's certainly not true of the devil. Look at some of the names that we have of the devil in the Bible. You might say, well, what's in a name? Well, there's a lot in a name if the name comes in a Bible, in the Bible, because biblical names are often an exact description of the character. Let me remind you of the names of the evil one, our enemy, in the Bible. He is Satan, meaning the adversary. He is the devil, meaning the slanderer. He is the destroyer. He is Beelzebul, which means Lord of the Flies. He is Belial, the low, the abject one. He is the wicked one. He is the god of this world. He is the prince of darkness. He is the dragon. He is the tormentor. He is the accuser. He is the deceiver, the liar, the murderer. Him who has the power of death. He is Abaddon, the enemy. He is the ruler of this world. He is the tempter. Now, there is nothing faintly amusing or benign about those names or the actions that they describe. So that is our enemy. And the devil, who was once described as the day star, the son of the dawn, that's Isaiah 14 and verse 12, who once ranked among the highest of God's angels, Ezekiel calls him a cherub, that's the highest rank of angels. That word cherub comes from the Hebrew verb to till or to plow, meaning a special rank of angels that were engaged in ceaseless activity for God. The evil one was a cherub who fell, what Martin Luther calls that hideous fall from heaven to hell. We don't know when it took place, sometime prehistory, but we do know why it took place. It took place because of pride, Isaiah 14 and verse 13, 1 Timothy 3 and verse 6. So whenever it was, he who was among the greatest of God's angels fell to become the wicked one, the enemy of God, and the deceiver of God's people. Now, while the ultimate downfall of the devil is certain, one of the reasons why Jesus came to earth was to destroy the devil, Hebrews 2 and verse 14, 1 John 3 and verse 8, nonetheless, it's foolish if we underestimate his ability today. He is a fallen angel, which speaks of his wickedness and in no sense speaks of his loss of spiritual power. Can I say that again? The fact that he is a fallen angel speaks of his wickedness, not in any sense loss of spiritual power. He is still at work today. He is still likely to attack us today. In fact, he is constantly on the move against us. We are harassed by him physically in opposition. Intellectually, he endeavours to undermine our belief. Morally, he tries to erode away our standards and behaviour. I think it's difficult to find a better description of the devil's activity than the one that Henry Law gave us in that remarkable little book, The Gospel in Genesis. Let me quote it to you. This is the devil. He never slumbers, never is weary, never relents, never abandons hope. He deals his blows alike at childhood's weakness, at youth's inexperience, at manhood's strength, and at the totterings of age. He watches to ensnare the morning thought. He departs not with the shadows of night. By his legions he is everywhere, at all times. He enters the palace, the hut, the fortress, the camp, the fleet. He invades every room of every dwelling, every pew of every sanctuary. He is busy with the busy. He hurries about with the active. He sits by each bed of sickness and whispers into each dying ear. As the spirit departs the tenement of clay, he draws his bow with unrelenting rage. He is at work at all time, and he'll be at work against us till the very last breath that we draw. So he's a real enemy. In one sense, it's true for us to say that in no sense for us is he a defeated enemy. This is where we fall into a great danger. And it's the fact that he is so active against us that many people claim to have seen the evil one. Let me quote to you from Richard Wurmbrand, the Lutheran minister imprisoned by the communists for 14 years. He wrote this in prison. It is no myth that Martin Luther and many other more ordinary men have seen the devil. I saw him once as a child. He grinned at me. This is the first time I have spoken about it in half a century. Alone in the cell now, I felt his presence again. It was dark and cold, and he was mocking me. So he can be very real, so real that some people can actually see him. I wonder if in your youth you ever read a novel called The Cloister and the Hearth. And in that particular novel, the hero's friend tries to cheer him up by occasionally saying, "Courage, comrade, the devil is dead." Now, not only is that quite untrue, he is not dead. Jesus came to destroy him. He may be in his death throes, but he is certainly not dead at the moment. Courage, enemy, the devil is dead. Not only is that not true, but that's not where we find victory. We do not find victory in a dead devil. We find our victory in a living God. Isn't that what our verse has been saying in the 23rd Psalm? Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. In the presence of this supreme evil spiritual power, thou can give me victory. That's what it's saying. That you can set me with all the equipment that I need. Our victory is found in a living God, not in a dead devil. Notice one or two phrases that we have at the end of this particular verse. We noticed in the last chapter that at night, the last talk last week at night, that the shepherd individually inspected the sheep for cuts and bruises as they entered the narrow door of the sheepfold. If he discovered any injuries at all, he would rub the grazes with oil to aid healing. Thou anointest my head with oil, says David. In spite of a powerful God, it's very easy for us to lose our sense of victory. And I don't think that this comes because of the major thrusts of the evil one. I believe that we lose our sense of victory because of the tiny things that happen to us each day, from the spiritual scratches and bruises of everyday living, emotional grazes, bruised consciences that have to be healed, the pummeling with lies that our mind receives from the deceits of the prince of darkness. All of these need the oils of forgiveness daily, and our God is willing to rub in those oils that night. There is still a balm in Gilead. Hallelujah for that. Still a balm in Gilead. We can still have the oils of forgiveness, the oils of healing. And there is also refreshment. For David says that his cup overflows. For some reason, sheep will not drink from a half-empty container, so the shepherd had to make sure that their container overflowed with water so that they can drink. And isn't our refreshment of an overflowing kind also? John 7 and verse 37. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink, and out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water. Oh, there we are. There is verse 5. Of the 23rd Psalm, the badge of victory. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, and my cup overflows. Now verse 6. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Dr. George Adam Smith, one of the great Old Testament scholars at the beginning of the century, had an intriguing translation for this last verse of the 23rd Psalm. He used to put it like this: surely goodness and mercy will follow me or hunt me out all the days of my life. And his saying that gives us the picture behind verse 6 of the 23rd Psalm. And that was the picture of the dogs that brought up the rear of the flock. Now last week I was saying that a shepherd used to use his sling, as the modern shepherd uses a sheepdog. And the shepherd would put a stone in the front of a sheep that was running away and turn it and bring him back. But I was very careful to say, or not to suggest, that the old biblical shepherd didn't use a sheepdog. He certainly used sheepdogs, and they used to bring up the stragglers of the flock. That very famous man, W.M. Thompson, in a book called The Land of the Book, says that in Bible times the shepherd walked before the sheep followed after, and the dogs brought up the rear. So what we have here is a picture of goodness and mercy doggedly pursuing us. Now that's one reading of one translation of the 23rd Psalm. But goodness and mercy pursue us, pursue after us, like the hounds that bring up the flock. And of course it was that thought that gave the idea to Francis Thompson of writing his famous poem, The Hounds of Heaven. So if you want a heading for this last verse of the psalm, it's The Hounds of Heaven. And of course it was Francis Thompson's poem, The Hounds of Heaven, that brought Dale Evans, the wife of the film star cowboy Roy Rogers, back to God. And in her own biography, she says that after the poem, she felt this: I saw that it was my own story of running and hiding from God. Over 18 years of sunshine and shadow, toil and pleasure, success and defeat, trying hard to get out of my ears and out of my life the sound of those steady, strong, haunting feet that follow me everywhere. David says, surely goodness and mercy will hunt after me. In David's mind, there was no doubt about it. He was going to be hunted by the goodness and mercy of God. Now, let's look at these two words for a moment. First of all, this word goodness. Now, I find it intriguing that elsewhere in the Old Testament, in fact, much more frequently, this word is translated pleasant or enjoyable or agreeable. So David is saying that the enjoyable experience, the agreeable experience, the pleasant experience, pursues after me all the days of my life. Now that's interesting, especially when you remember that David is being chased by his son Absalom. You remember the coup d'etat that's driven him from Jerusalem? He's down on the Jericho plain, or he's going up into the hills of Upper Gilead. He's got no tents for his family and his soldiers. He's got no food for them. And yet he is saying, goodness pursues me all the days of my life. The enjoyable experience follows me all the days of my life. So if dogs are following after David, they're pretty vicious dogs. No, says David, they're not. Can't you see, says David, that no matter how disappointing or frustrating or depressing your experience is, that if you are God's people, nothing but good can come of it. That's my experience, says David. I can't tell you what good is going to come of it, but I know that only good will come of it. Indeed, said David, that's what I've already experienced. Can't you see that? Yes, it's true, I've got no tents. I've got no food. I've been pursued out of my own capital city, out of my own palace by my own son. But can't you see that very painful experience has meant that I have had a new experience of God? So it's true. Goodness will pursue me all the days of my life. And then this word mercy. Well, no one's found a very good translation for this word, mercy. It hasn't been discovered. Maybe you will give us the best translation of this word into modern English. We've not found the translation of the word mercy. It's not our word mercy. No one has yet bettered Coverdale's translation. Coverdale gave us loving kindness. That's nearer to it. But while that expresses, forgive the pun, the quality of mercy, it in no sense expresses the quantity. And that's what is behind this word. Loving kindness, you ought to have another clause on there which expresses the eternal loving kindness of God. The kind of loving kindness that pursues to forgive, to forgive, to forgive, to restore, to restore, to restore, until the end of our days. It's that kind of loving kindness. The kind of loving kindness that pursued to restore David over 18 years. I've been a Christian for exactly 18 years, and it's that loving kindness that had to pursue me daily to forgive me and to restore me as a child of God. If you're going to use this word mercy, you must express something of the eternal nature of the mercy of God. It pursues after us all the days of our life. Well, David's whole life is a good example both of the goodness of God and of the loving kindness that pursues him. I don't know any other story that illustrates the mercy of God towards an unbeliever as the story of Mutiny on the Bounty. On my day off sometimes I go to Greenwich, to the National Maritime Museum, and I look at that showcase, and I say one day when I have time, when I have a whole year off, I'm going to write the most exciting film script. One day when I have a year off and I have a lot of time, I'm going to write the most exciting historical novel. Because no one has really written the story of the Mutiny on the Bounty yet. It's always been written from a secular sense, and someone has got to write it from a Christian point of view, because that really is the point of the whole story. I'm sure you know the story of the Mutiny on the Bounty. Even if you do, I'm going to tell it to you again tonight. How Lieutenant Bligh left England in 1787, outward bound for the South Seas to collect breadfruit trees for the government, and how they landed at Tahiti in the Pacific, and they spent the first few weeks having a holiday. And they found, the sailors found, it was a marvellous island. Not only was it a tropical island, not only could they lie in blue seas under a blue sky, and not only was the island full of marvellous fruit to eat, but it had an unusual quality that they hadn't discovered in civilization so far. That the islands were full of the most beautiful girl. And they had a strange custom, that they were to give themselves to strangers. Now these poor English sailors had not met anything like this before. It was paradise on earth for them. And they enjoyed themselves. Well, Lieutenant Bligh at the end called them back to their duties, and they got back in their boat and set sail again to look for the breadfruit trees. But after a short time, a man called Fletcher Christian led the mutineers. And they said, look, we're taking charge of this boat. We're going back to Tahiti and to that heaven on earth and those girls, and you're not going to stop us. And they put Captain Bligh and the 18 loyal sailors to Captain Bligh in an open boat, and they pushed them over the side and they set sail. They sailed 4,000 miles and ended up in the East Indies, which is a miracle story in itself. But Fletcher Christian with the mutineers went back to Tahiti. They managed to persuade a great number of girls to come and sail with them, and they set sail again. They only had one thing that governed where they sailed, that was not to be caught. And in the end, they found another island called Pitcairn Island. Not like Tahiti, no broad expanses of sand. It was caused by a volcanic eruption, but it was uninhabited. Now here, the sailors were going to establish heaven on earth. Just to live with these girls for the rest of their lives, that really was heaven, and to enjoy the tropical vegetation and the tropical climate. And so they scuttled their boat, so no one would now know that they were the mutineers, and they started to live life on this island. Unfortunately, someone took ashore the ship's copper kettle, and they thought, well, you know, there's something necessary with girls. It's wine, women, and so on, and we haven't got any wine, so let's make something that we can drink. So they started in the copper kettle to distill the roots of some of the trees, and they made the most powerful drink. And straight away, they started, all of them, to drink very heavily, and what they planned to become heaven on earth became the nightmarish hell that lasted for 10 years. Some of the crew went mad. One committed suicide by jumping over the cliff. They all lived in a bestial way. In the end, there were only 2 men left. The rest had drunk themselves to death. And the women now had managed to capture the firearms of the remaining 2 men and said, don't you come near us. And the women, with, as they were now, 18 children, barricaded themselves in a dwelling that they had made on one side of the island. So they were these 2 men left. The names of the 2 men that were left were Alexander Smith and Edward Young. Edward Young was by far the older man. He was ill with asthma, and he knew that he was about to die. And he wanted something to bring back recollections of his youth. The peace, the serenity of his home in England. Yes, England didn't quite have the climate of their tropical island. Yes, there weren't girls in England that were so generous with their favours as they were on the tropical island. But he wanted a memory of his youth. And he managed to find the old ship's box. You'll see it in the National Maritime Museum to this day. And in the box, they found the ship's Bible. And he brought out the Bible, and they began to read. Edward Young could read, but Alexander Smith wasn't able to read. And Edward Young taught Alexander Smith to read by beginning at the beginning of Genesis and showing him one word after another. By the time they got to Leviticus, the awe of God had fallen upon them. By the time that they got to Psalms, they realized that it was a songbook. And even though they didn't know the tunes, they started to sing these as songs. Before they got to the New Testament, the older man, Edward Young, had died. Before they got to the New Testament, the women and the children had come back, because they could see at a distance there was such a radical change in the lives of these 2 men. By the time that Alexander Smith got to the New Testament, he was well able to read, and he discovered in the New Testament the thing that he had felt in the Old Testament, that there was forgiveness, that there was new birth. And he described in his own words in his diary the wonderful experience of finding the New Testament brought to him and the forgiveness of sins that he found in Jesus Christ. 18 years after the mutineers landed on Pitcairn Island, a ship out from Boston in America landed, and one mutineer gave himself up. And the captain of the boat said, well, look, I'm afraid I'm not taking you prisoner. This is the most perfect community I've ever seen. And he went back to Boston and he said, I have found, we say that in this country, New England, we're trying to establish God's country. He says, the only place where I've really seen it is a tiny community in the South Seas on Pitcairn Island where everyone is a rejoicing believer in Jesus Christ. There is the mercy of God to endlessly pursue the unbeliever. Now you go to the National Maritime Museum any day you like, and you'll see a cabinet with some of the relics of the crew of the Bounty, those that managed to survive those 18 years. And you will find in the strange language of museums where it says a remarkable spiritual revival took place on this island. Now that, for a museum, is a tremendous testimony. A tremendous testimony. So if you have a year before I do, and you've got time to go to the Maritime Museum and can read up all those ancient documents, you write that historical novel. It'll be one of the most exciting historical novels ever written, because it will have a marvellous Christian ending. Someone's got to write the book about the mutiny on the Bounty. There is the God that pursues us. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me, shall hunt after me, shall doggedly follow my footsteps all the days of my life. It's not going to stop. God's mercy is not going to stop. I visited someone in hospital this afternoon, one of our students, and she's just had a virus infection, and I could go and say, well, I know just what it's like having got better from glandular fever. I said that the worst thing is the guilt that you feel, because you feel that you're not saying your prayers in the morning as much as you should, and you're not reading your Bible. That's the most depressing thing, but I keep feeling guilty. There's no need to feel guilty. You're going to fail God until the last breath that you draw. But God pursues after you with goodness and mercy, and you will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now those words can bring to your mind a miserable picture. Because when you think of a house, you think of a mansion, because that's what the New Testament says. And every mansion that you've been to is a deadly place. It's damp and cold. Who wants to live in a mansion anyway? Well, let's look for a moment at those words in John 14, because they are most important. Let's look as we close at John 14 and see exactly what it says. John 14. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. Now, if you've got your own Bible there, cross out the word rooms. No, don't do that. But my translation there is caravanserai. Now, that's not just my translation. That's the translation of two great New Testament scholars. They say that if you have rooms here, it makes nonsense of the text. Because in the ancient world, there weren't rooms as we know it today. And that's not what is suggested here. What is suggested here is a caravanserai. That is an ancient motel, or a camel motel, or camel hotel, however you express that. A place where you went in the middle of your journey and you rested for the night. There may be a dwelling in one corner where the proprietor lived, owned by Joe Smith, areas vacant for you to park your camels and set them to graze, and you'd pitch your tents. But that's what a caravanserai was like. It was a place where you could pitch your tent, put your camels to graze, and you left your camels grazing. You left your tents, and you went over to the oasis in the center, where there were trees and where there was running water, and you used to say to yourself, what is it? It's Thursday. Fred's always here on a Thursday night. You would go and look for Fred. You knew the people that would be there on a Thursday night. You knew that your friends would be there. And you look forward to a caravanserai, because you'd say, well, it's Thursday, Fred will be here, Joe will be here, the whole gang will be here. It was a place of enjoyment and fellowship, of feasting and laughter. And that's the picture that is behind these words. Do you want me to prove that to you? Because I can. Shall I do that for you? What happened when a camel caravan was going through the desert? That they kept having to stop. Someone would lose their saddlebag, and they'd say, whoa, stop while we fix it again. Or Mrs. Smith would say, I'm afraid you've got to stop, I've got to change Junior's nappy, and so they all stop again. So the leader of the caravan would say, well, look, we'll never get there in time. It'll be full by the time we'll get there. And what he would do is he'd send his servant on ahead. He'd say, would you please book at the caravanserai a place for 15 camels with the appropriate families? He sent his servant on ahead. Isn't that what we have in this text? Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go ahead to prepare a place for you? Jesus Christ is the servant that's gone on ahead to book our place in the heavenly caravanserai. The whole picture here is a feasting of laughter and of an enjoyable experience. That's our picture of heaven. When I had this virus through October, I normally have a lunch in the West End about once every 2 months, for some artists, some people in advertising that have become Christians in the last 2 years. And I have a lunch with them, and we have a Bible study at the end of the lunch. They're very creative people. Some of the top, they work for the top advertising houses in London. And instead of sending me a get well card, they sent me 7 little badges for me to put on my Festival of Light t-shirt. 7 little badges. You know those little badges with slogans on? And one for every day of the week. And my favorite one, let me tell you, my favorite one was Sunday. And Sunday's badge just said very simply, have a nice forever. Now that's the thing about forever. It's going to be nice. It's not going to be churchy. It's not going to be tedious. It's not going to be boring. It's going to be nice. Because we're going to be there in the most enjoyable experience forever and ever and ever and ever. Now in the same way that we never look for holidays saying, oh dear me, we're going on a fortnight's holiday. You look forward to the excitement of holiday. I think we ought to look forward to the excitement of being with God forever and ever. And of course, it's don't ever get your doctrines of heaven from the hymns. That always leads you into a lot of trouble. You know that famous hymn, you know, casting down our crowns before him. And someone used to worry about that, saying, well, they wondered how you got your crown back. They were rather worried that, you know, you might grow a new one every second. And then the awful thought used to come that it was probably on a piece of elastic and came back with a pig. So don't ever get to your doctrines of eternity from the hymns. We're going to have a nice forever. Because it's our Father's house. It's a family house. That's a very dangerous thing. You know, Martin Luther had to drag himself to say the Lord's Prayer. He hated to say the Lord's Prayer because he couldn't say, Our Father, which art in heaven, because he had such a stern father that it always created the wrong picture for him. And sometimes it's true that some of us come from such sad homes that the picture of heaven as a home gives us the wrong picture in our minds. But if you know a happy home, if you come from a happy home, that's what heaven is going to be like. It's going to be a happy, homely atmosphere forever and ever and ever. I've called this psalm, He is everything to me. And I believe that David, within the 6 verses of this psalm, gives us a picture of everything that he can be to us in every department of the human life. He is everything to us. Now, we've begun to study the 23rd Psalm over 4 Thursday evenings. Please don't finish studying the Psalm until the moment that you step into heaven, because you will find, as you study it, more and more things, so that continually through life, you will be able to say, I hope, He is everything to me.